This morning I want to talk about the spring holiday, Palm Sunday, which is today. Palm Sunday happens a week before Easter. Now, Easter is celebrated on the first Sunday after the first full moon, after the vernal equinox, so it's like a movable feast. It keeps changing depending on both the solar and the lunar calendars. Usually, it coincides with Passover, which makes sense since the Last Supper of Easter week was in all probability a Seder supper. Remember, all the disciples, Jesus, everybody in the story are Jewish. Before I begin, let me invite those of you who struggle. I mean, I know this congregation. I've been here 18, 19, 20 months. And, you know, you're humanists, and that's cool. I mean, I'm thinking of myself as a humanist too, but the thing is, we can get pretty reactive to Christian material when it's what they call cross cringe. And, you know, so to try to prevent that, to help you kind of de-escalate the issues. I always enjoy when these Christian holidays come around. As a sixth generation UU, I always enjoy trying to help you understand the material, because there's a lot. It goes back. Unitarians and Universalists both have a long and nuanced and empowered relationship with the Christian myth. So let me proceed. To start out with, trying to think of these stories and this biblical imagery the way I was taught to approach them in my Unitarian Sunday school. Think of them as, and I can hear my fourth grade Sunday school teacher, think of these stories as springboards to contemplation. Springboards to contemplation. Take, for instance, the Passover story recounted during the Seder meal. And some of you, and probably most of you, have had a Seder, and they talk about that whole thing. And in a month, I'll talk about it more. But I'm going to talk a little bit about, because it foreshadows the whole event on Palm Sunday. So the events in the Passover story are related during the Seder meal. And to understand stories of this kind, we have to think of them. We have to think of all religious literature as myth. And by myth, I do not mean primitive untruth at all. I mean epic poetry, inviting our imaginative engagement and elaboration. Whatever you do, don't take these stories literally. That's what fundamentalists do. They're metaphorical. Whatever the story under consideration, it's not a one-time event. I mean, it may recount events, but as a myth, it's more than a one-time event. And not only that, all the aspects of the story, it may be written in a linear narrative style, but all the aspects are always happening all the time. Pharaoh-like despots are exploiting their subjects. Heroic leaders are inspiring disciples. These things happen across the globe every day. This is what Joe Campbell said. That the continuing story of Beauty and the Beast stands this afternoon at the corner of Fifth Avenue and 43rd Street, waiting for the traffic light to change. This is happening right now, and right in front of us, and right in our homes and neighborhoods. While myth tells the story, ritual acts it out. And so they always go together, myth and ritual. So in what I'm talking about, the Exodus is the myth, the Seder is the ritual. It's a struggle sometimes, but we always have to try to transcend literalism if we want to understand religious literature. When you see Exodus as more than a one-time event, but as a symbol, a paradigm for liberation and change, that's when you begin to get it mythically. Stop thinking about it historically, or definitely not literally. The Exodus is happening right now. Let me approach this from another direction. It helps our appreciation of the Passover story as metaphor when we learn that the word Egypt in Hebrew means the narrow place. To be enslaved in Egypt means being bound to a narrow place, to a narrow vision, and a narrow politics. We all know Egypt. We've all been there. It's a rigid world of natives versus immigrants, gays versus straights, patriots versus socialists. A world that passes for respectable propriety among present-day Egyptians across America. The thing about myth, though, all of its parts are happening all the time. Just as we're mythically stuck in Egypt when we're caught up in narrow ways of thinking, at all times, there's also an invitation to leave Egypt behind and cross over to freedom. For our biblical, or our ancestors of biblical legend, that freedom came once they agreed to live by a covenant. Just like our UUCF affirmation that we recited earlier, loves the doctrine that we share, the quest of truth is our sacrament, and service is our prayer, to dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve human needs. Thus do we covenant with one another. Well, ours is less patriarchal, perhaps, than the ancient Hebrews, but it's a covenant just the same. Here's my point. From a mythic perspective, you leave slavery behind when you bind together with like-minded, imaginative people for creative purposes. When we gather together in the spirit of our affirmation, there's almost no limit to what we can accomplish. Until we forget to live in freedom and find ourselves wandering in the wilderness again, sometimes for an awful long while. Now, hundreds of years after the Exodus came the events described in the New Testament. The story of an unofficial rabbi from the provinces who, after a brief ministry in the countryside, comes with his ragtag band triumphantly into Jerusalem. All four Gospels recount the enthusiasm he met that day. Enthusiasm, which we know, was dashed within a week. I'll do what I can to make sense of that story next week. This morning, I want to look, though, at this image of Jesus triumphantly entering the capital city. And I want to look at it through the same lens which I just briefly used to look at Exodus. That is, this kind of mythic analysis. Considered mythically, Jesus' triumphal moment is a paradigm. It's paradigmatic. It's an archetypal image of the reformer. The image is bigger, really, even than Jesus, and it keeps happening. To illustrate, I want to consider how this inner reformer archetype that I'm holding up also informed the heart of a 17th century literary hero from Massachusetts and the efforts of early 20th century reformers right here in California. I do this to help illustrate how Christian myth, like Jewish myth, like all myth, is never about a single event. It keeps happening all the time and everywhere. It's really a way of describing life reality poetically. And as I pointed out before, every aspect keeps happening. So to understand the Palm Sunday story, we need first to see and understand the archetype. Then we see how it's reflected or re-expressed in other venues, perhaps closer to home, and with less baggage for some. When you're lost in the rain in Juarez, and it's Easter time too, begins Bob Dylan's masterful, just like Tom Thumb's blues. Amidst sickness, despair, prostitutes, and saints, the singer recounts a trip south of the border where he encounters mysterious, powerful women like St. Annie and Sweet Melinda, corrupt authorities, and other archetypal forces until pulled by gravity, negativity, drunkenness, illness, remorse, and memories, he gathers himself together and goes home. I'm going back to New York City. I do believe I've had enough. Pope Francis's visit last month to Juarez touched me deeply. He was there to celebrate the improvement in conditions, or the improved conditions in that border town over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. 6 or 7 years ago, when I was serving a church in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the UU ministers and religious educators from the Mountain Desert District gathered in El Paso. On a free afternoon, I crossed into Ciudad Juarez, just like Tom Thumb's blues echoing in my head the whole time. It was a powerful experience and troubling. Human trafficking, gang, and drug-related activity had left Juarez with the highest murder rate by far of any city in North America. Dozens of desperately poor children sought handouts. I remember thinking, this has got to change. This has got to change. And I look up, just as I'm saying that in my head, in front of me, Casa de Cambio, a house of change, I thought. An evangelical church? A community center dedicated to social uplift? Alas, the storefront was nothing more than a currency conversion booth. A convenient place to change dollars into pesos or vice versa. It's funny, no matter how poor a community is, there's always some entrepreneurs ready to squeeze a few more dollars out of any tourists or anybody else who suddenly needed to exchange their currency. It's interesting, currency conversion is the whole thing that led to Jesus' denouement. It all came out of Casa de Cambio. After a brief preaching and storytelling ministry in Galilee, Jesus, accompanied by a group of loyal disciples, went to Jerusalem. Not to die, but to proclaim his vision of the imminent kingdom and to proclaim it to the throng of worshipers there to celebrate Passover. Whatever else this figure Jesus was, he was definitely a change agent. He entered the city largely unnoticed by authorities, but he soon, the very next day, attracted lots of attention by his dramatic purging of the temple. Now, people from all over the Middle East were visiting, as I noted, that Passover week. Proper protocol required making a burnt offering of some animal, most often, because it was the cheapest, a pigeon. The Sadducean temple cult, that was the Sadducees were the leaders of the temple priesthood, required that these be purchased, these sacrificial animals, they had to be purchased with coin from Israel. No other kind of coin was permitted, so the money changers were there to convert coins from Egypt or Rome or Babylon into coins from Egypt, from Israel, and at high interest. The temple priests also got a little bit of a kickback, kind of an executive bonus for moving the contract that way. All this made Jesus angry, and he declared that the priests had turned a house of God into a den of robbers. His act of overturning the tables of the money changers is found in all 4 gospel accounts. But in Mark, the oldest account, is added Jesus' remark that the temple was meant to be a house of prayer for all peoples. In Mark's telling, Jesus is more than a reformer who wants to clean up temple corruption. The change he has in mind is revolutionary. Not only to clean up the temple, but to transform it. Not just for the people of Israel, but for everyone, the world over. Very universalist message. this act, together with his teaching in the temple area, quite likely added to his popularity with the madding crowd, but also incurred the enmity of the Sadducean temple clique. At this point, Pontius Pilate, the Roman military governor, possibly fearing that a popular religious leader teaching about some kingdom other than Caesar's might become the center of a popular disturbance or revolt against Rome, had the man arrested. Following a summary hearing, he was condemned and crucified, just like that, as a criminal. With this abrupt and tragic conclusion to his and his followers' high hopes, the story of Jesus ends. Or does it? Finding hope in the midst of such an unexpected and utter collapse is next week's story, Easter. Today, as I said, I want to focus on the high hopes, the triumphant entry into the city and the welcoming and the new vision of a transformed and liberated faith and world that we see in Palm Sunday. Now, Nathaniel Hawthorne was a Unitarian, and many of you probably read one or two of his books, perhaps under duress in high school. His novel, The Scarlet Letter, concerns another liberal universalistic spirit who comes to the capital city in hopeful expectation only to find scorn and contempt. Hester Prynne, the story's hero, arrives from afar and all alone. When it becomes obvious about a year later that, well, about a half a year later, or a little more, that she's pregnant, and that she won't reveal to the civil and religious authorities who her lover was, she's forced to wear a bright scarlet A, letter A, on her bodice as a badge of her adultery. Hawthorne's descriptions of the cruel, narrow-minded scolds who condemn Hester and her innocent child are chilling. But such was the scene in those days. The eloquent young Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale, unlike most of his contemporaries, does not preach hellfire and damnation or the harsh punishment of sinners. People admire him, they like him, but they don't listen to him. Compassion and tenderness are not their way, and they hold no truck. It turns out, of course, that Dimmesdale, in a moment of weakness, was Hester's lover and is the father of little Pearl. Moreover, the guilt of living with that knowledge cripples him so dreadfully that in the end he collapses in grief and shame. Shocked as the Puritan authorities are at all of this, it's nothing compared to their outrage that Hester would not be shamed. She wears her scarlet A with pride, intricately embroidering it into a beautiful, striking adornment. The shame and blame authoritarian culture does in Reverend Dimmesdale. He doesn't have the courage to step outside the rigid patriarchal order, and in the end, it kills him. But it doesn't destroy Hester. She, of course, has the comfort of being a very private person and feeling strong in her, you know, introversion. The young prophetic Dimmesdale, forced to comply with public rules and regulations, is crushed. The unbending patriarchal order survives for several generations, along with its shame and blame mentality, poised to crush almost anyone who dares challenge it. Life in California a century ago was different in many ways from that of ancient Palestine or 17th century Massachusetts. The ruling authorities, however, like those of 250 and 2,000 years earlier, were an often harsh and hard-driving clique who ruled not so much with severity as practiced carelessness. The powerful Southern Pacific Railroad and its major clients dominated our state's politics. Here in greater LA and the city of LA and in San Francisco as well, the two biggest cities then as now. Municipal corruption was rampant, replete with generous kickbacks and bonuses. Tension between capital and labor simmered under the surface, nurturing a constant threat of violence. Then, quite suddenly, actually, vigorous reformers challenged the power of the railroad and successfully passed a dramatic set of badly needed reforms that promoted good government and democracy and soothed class conflict. Hiram Johnson, a progressive Republican attorney who had successfully prosecuted corruption in San Francisco, was elected governor of the state 105 years ago this November. The legislative accomplishments of his administration are impressive. Direct democracy, women's suffrage, labor legislation, and railroad and utilities reform. Then, almost as quickly as they strode onto the scene, the reformers vanished. 1911 was their high watermark. Instead of maintaining their focus at the state level, California progressives turned their attention to the presidential election of 1912. GOP infighting led to the formation of the Progressive Bull Moose Party, which nominated the still youthful ex-president Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt won here in California, but he lost the election to Virginia-born Woodrow Wilson, the first Southerner in the White House in 62 years since Zachary Taylor had left. And which led him immediately upon his inauguration to the reintroduction of segregated washrooms in the District of Columbia and throughout federal buildings across the South. Hard economic times and then World War I quickly contributed to the collapse of the Progressive Party. By 1916, it was totally over. Hiram Johnson became increasingly reactionary. Teddy Roosevelt withdrew from politics, his sympathizers displaced by conservatives within the leadership of the GOP, and war loomed. Before long, the Southern Pacific Railroad was controlling Sacramento once again. Ancient Palestine, long ago Boston, and early 20th century California. What about here, today? Where have we seen youthful reformist energy thwarted by an unyielding old guard? Where do shame and blame still work to keep beloved community and safe and effective government at bay? Obsessive observance to the letter over the spirit of the law. The belittlement and criminalization of spiritual renewal or liberal reform. Where? These things happen everywhere. They happen right here in the neighborhoods of Orange County, in our city halls and Sacramento, in Washington, D.C., and in Damascus, Sichuan, and Tunis as well. Passover and Palm Sunday are not about obscure events that may have happened centuries ago. Yes, in a way, but that's just the seed. The Exodus, the entry into Jerusalem, these things are happening every day, along with all other aspects of the story, like the trail, confusion, and picking up the pieces. All the other aspects of the myth that usually, though not invariably, follow. Not invariably, as Hester's capacity to transcend her predicament by refusing to be shamed in the face of love makes that clear. And as Franklin Roosevelt's eventual picking up of his cousin's, Teddy's, liberal agenda also makes clear. My intention this morning has been to help our members understand the ways in which mythic archetypes like Exodus and the entry into Jerusalem are alive at every hand, finding exemplification over and over in the drama of our lives and in our body politics. Think of President Obama and his liberal allies garnering the political will to pass health care reform. As always, the Sadducean, Puritan, Southern Pacific cult of Limbaugh, McConnell and Scalia and their like lurks in the wing, collecting their bonuses and praying for the young leader's collapse, a collapse they will be all too happy to accommodate, even help bring about should the opportunity arise. And we've seen this, I think, for 8 years. But for now, for today, let us celebrate the triumph of hope and possibility over those forces that always threaten. Let us admire young and fearless prophets and liberators wherever they find the courage to speak out and lead, and wherever followers find among themselves the audacity to hold such people up as the leaders they are. President Barack Obama, Hester Prynne, the young Hiram Johnson, UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld, Hussana, blessed are they, all of them that come in the name of peace and beloved community and healthy progressive change, who proclaim a new era or kingdom or Casa de Cambio, and challenge all of us, all our brothers and sisters across the aisle, across town, and across the world to build a new order with them, not of shame and blame any longer, not of power over, not of patriarchy or oligarchy or power clique, but of love and compassion. Let us celebrate that, the triumph, when and wherever it occurs, and however fragile and temporary it may be, let us celebrate the triumph of love and compassion and hope. So may it be. Shalom. Amen. Namaste.